Welcome to another edition of Pitt Bulletin Legal News Radio, part of the Pitt Bulletin Legal News Network. Broadcasting each Tuesday night at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the show covers the latest pit bull news across the country, including breed-specific legislation, the real story behind recently reported dog attacks, fact-checking on dogsbite.org, litigation updates, and a live call-in discussion. Call 646-595-4137 or join us in chat during the show.
Welcome to Pitbull Legal News Radio, April 7th, 2015. I'm your host, Fred Cray, with my co-host, the infamous Chris Brown Sugar Diaz from Stop ESL, along with Laura Hayes, who is the web mistress. Tonight, we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic that everyone should know about, and that is presenting the case against breed discriminatory laws to governmental entities, meaning city councils, city commissions, whatever governmental entity is involved in passing laws for a city or county. But first, let's talk about who's not here tonight and why. Denise is not here tonight in chat, so Laura's going to open the chat. And it'll probably be unmoderated tonight. I don't know, Laura, can you look at it a little bit?
Yeah, I'll take a look at it.
So, because this is a topic that people might have questions on, actually. So if you have a question, put it in chat, and Laura will try and get it to us, and we'll try to answer it on HBO Overtime with Bill Maher. But Denise is getting married this weekend, so she's going through all the premarital checkup things, like manicures, pedicures, you know, hair appointments, pantyhose checks, you name it. It's all there.
Premarital checkup. That sounds vaguely wrong.
Yeah, it does. But when has that stopped me before?
True. That's very true.
That's right. So so that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Let's talk about last week's show first.
Previously on Pitt Bulletin Legal News Radio.
Laura's not on, but let me ask her. Laura, did you watch Game of Thrones?
It wasn't on last week. On this week, I believe.
Yeah, are you going to watch it?
Yes.
Okay, did you watch, I meant actually to say, did you watch Mad Men?
Oh, have I watched it in the past? Oh, yes. I'm all caught up.
Well, Mad Men debuted this. The new Mad Men started this, I think, last week. Have you watched that?
No, I haven't caught up with the newest episodes.
All right. Well, those of you who are interested in Mad Men, it was a very interesting opening season. And I guess Game of Thrones is on this Sunday night?
I believe so, yes. Looking forward to it.
Is it going to be 1 hour or is it going to be more than an hour?
I don't know. We need Denise. She knows all the TV questions.
Yeah, that's right. She does. Okay, well, let's go back to Chris, who's on the hot seat again, because you know she has these times when she drinks so much she falls on the railroad tracks and gets her leg cut off. In which case, she forgets what was on the previous show. So, Chris,
I'm having one of those moments. I didn't. I usually take notes, and I can't. Okay, sorry. Gore is my hero. Last week we talked about criminal liability for dog bites and when a person can be charged with, you know, being, I guess, criminally negligent or manslaughter and other similar charges related to dog bites and dog bite fatalities.
Were you shocked at that?
What, that people can be held criminally liable for something
yes.
like that?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't. I was a little shocked that there were as many cases as there have been, because it does seem to be sort of a difficult thing to prove, and even more so, it seems like a difficult thing to get the prosecutors to pursue.
Yeah,
probably because it is difficult to, you know, to prove that a person. I mean, unless there's really, some of the cases that we spoke about last week were really over the top and
yeah,
egregious.
And that's
so,
why they got prosecuted,
you know,
because they were really over the top.
Yeah. But for the most part, it seems like those cases don't really go anywhere.
Laura, what was your takeaway from last week's criminal liability lesson?
I wasn't really surprised that there were so many cases. I think that it was good to highlight there that, in fact, there has been that many cases about it, because I read a lot of comments and hear a lot of discussion where people are saying people should be held criminally liable because that will, you know, stop this from happening.
Right.
So people should be aware that it is, in fact, happening, and there's a real risk for people who do not manage their dangerous dogs. As people think something more is to be done, they should know that that avenue is open and is being used.
Yeah, well, I think it's also interesting to see the law being used that the dog becomes a dangerous instrumentality, you know, as a weapon, for example. That's an interesting thing that, you know, that's developed also that I wasn't really aware of that, but it makes total sense when you think about somebody sicking their dog on somebody. So how do you spell sicking?
Yeah.
Is what I want to know, Laura.
Isn't it S-T-C, right?
I don't know. I'm just being devilman. All right. So, last week we did highlight.
My autocorrect is failing me on that one, Fred. Sorry.
Okay, that's all right. My question is, I mean, sick. There's in the law. There's a when somebody misspells something, you put in parentheses S-I-C, right, Laura?
Right.
So my question is, that doesn't have to do with dogs, but if you had a dog and somebody was sicking their dog on you, how would you spell that? Would it be S-I-C-C-I-N-G? Would it be S-I-C-I-N-G?
Apparently not. I typed that in and nothing came up, so I don't know.
All right, well, I guess they'll just have to drop that language and what you do in the law, use some other word. You know, he told his dog to attack, you know, or whatever. So, all right. So I think that the takeaway from last week's show is that that if your dog has previous problems, you really need to take some kind of action or be concerned about criminal liability if the dog kills somebody or, you know, does something, mm-hmm. does some real damage to someone that, and, you know, you see this. I thought the most, one of the crazier cases was the guy who had 6 pit bulls. And then said to the police, I should have gotten rid of them a long time ago, and that was the basis for his conviction. That was an interesting case. But
yeah,
let's go.
That I found a little shocking that was.
Well, that's an admission. That's an admission, and, you know, if they have it, you would be shocked at how many cases there are where people say things like an excited utterance or whatever, right. And that's the key. So, all right, let's do a little news. And, of course, this week, Chris was famous. She got into the HuffPost on the issue of the Selena dog seizure of a trucker's dog who was – tell us about it, Chris.
There is a gentleman in Selena, Kansas, who – he is a trucker by trade, full-time, and he has a mailing address. Registered, you know, his mail goes to an address in Selena, Kansas. Selena has a pit bull ban, and he recently adopted a dog that falls under the definition of a pit bull in that particular town. He had returned from one of his jobs and had gone out to eat and left the dog with a friend, and the dog apparently had gotten loose. Now, there's, you know, a little bit of a question with this particular gentleman because he, you know, when I say that he has a mailing address in Selena, we're talking about somebody who is on the road, I believe he estimated 50 weeks out of the year.
Yeah, out of 52.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're really talking about somebody who's spending a very, very minimal amount of time and has an address as almost a formality, it seems. Unfortunately, the dog was, a neighbor had complained. The dog was picked up by animal control. The gentleman in question had, when they came to take a look at the dog, he had asked, apparently, to see a search warrant, and he was told that they did not need a search warrant for the dog.
Because under the statute,
ultimately the dog.
Just because, let me just say, because I've read the statute basically allows that. If you read the statute now, the question isn't whether isn't whether the police can do it. The question is whether that's constitutional to allow police to enter a house to take a pit bull. The statute allows it, but I don't think it's constitutional. I think the only time that the Supreme Court of the United States has allowed people to go into a house without a warrant is under exigent circumstances where the evidence could be, you know, for example, burned or, you know, whatever. And in this case, that's not possible. So I don't think that statute is. I think it improperly allows for warrantless seizures of dogs. But go ahead. It's just my
opinion. Yeah, and I would definitely agree with you there. But there's some dispute because officials are saying that because the dog was visible, that they didn't need a warrant.
But they would have had a trespass on the property. To unless the guy's house is right on the street. Most houses are set back far enough that you can't use the plain view doctrine to say, well, we trespassed on your property and looked in your window, and now we see you have a pit bull. They still need a warrant to come on the property at all. That's your personal. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, that's just, you know, that's their position. Clearly, as Fred has illustrated, this is not a position that is necessarily a legitimate or a legal one. But that is, you know, what the officials are saying. So the dog ultimately went with animal control, and the owner is being fined. He is saying that he is going to fight this. It kind of begs a very interesting question as to what constitutes residency, particularly considering the fact that, you know, he's not there for the absolute vast majority of the year. And so, you know, he has vowed to fight this and to try to get his dog back. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see how it plays out yet again. This is now, this is maybe the fifth case now in Salina this year.
Yeah.
That we've seen.
And the question is, why are they so gung-ho about it? It has to come from somewhere in the government. Whether it's the prosecutor or what.
Yeah, it is very strange how adamant they are about taking these cases to, you know, their furthest reach. I mean, we've seen in the past where the prosecutor just would not let up another case that had happened this year. We've seen in the past where they reopened a case against a person after the case was dismissed based on the result of a DNA test. That case ultimately never ended up going anywhere because the person moved out of town before the case could be brought up again. It's very strange. It almost seems like there's a personal investment of some kind, either, you know, ego or emotion or something. Something is going on here.
It's causing the place where there's a veterinarian in town that is classifying pit bulls. Dr. Atherton.
Yes, this is a place that has Dr. Atherton is their identifying vet. He is the one who is, you know, making the identifications and determining whether or not a dog is a pit bull. He is also the one who determined that a pure breed dog that was not targeted was a pit bull because of its tooth structure.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like he's. I don't know why a vet would want to get involved in this kind of thing. I just don't understand that. I actually talked to him on the telephone when I was trying to find out if he had any records that related to classification, and he wouldn't give me his fax number. That's the kind of guy he is.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm saying about that.
Yeah.
I've never had that happen before.
And, you know, it's particularly odd because, I mean, this is not a private home phone number that was being requested. It's a fax number. It's a business line. It's not
right.
Like you couldn't find it, you know, by...
No, you can't find it.
Punching
it's not,
in
it's
the
no,
name.
I, listen, I've tried to find it, and it's nowhere to be found. If anybody has... from Salina, Kansas, has Dr. Atherton's fax number. Please email me.
Oh, we can. Yeah, I can get that for you, Fred.
Okay,
I
good.
Didn't know you were still looking for it.
Yep.
We will absolutely.
I want to send him. I want to send him a Freedom of Information Act request, in which we go back now. Back when there was another case, we made a Freedom of Information Act request to Salina, and of course they gave us the. It's going to cost $2,000 to produce these records. So I think in order to get those records, we're going to have some kind of fundraiser, which brings us to the next question, which is, are we almost ready to do our fundraiser? I think we are.
Yes,
we're right
we are
on the
very
cusp.
Close to launching our first fundraiser under our brand new 501c3. And so, you know, this is actually for the dog that I had just mentioned. That was a paper dog. Also did not belong to a resident. And all the details of that are, you know, will be included. The information about the dog in the case that we can include because there was an agreement made in a deal to get the dog returned to his family. So the things that we can include, we will be including. And there's, you know, going to be quite a bit of information there about the dog. And, you know, this particular dog actually turns out is sort of a quasi-hero because a week ago, I think it was, they were outside, the family was outside working on their property, and the dog had alerted the adults to the fact that the dog owner's nephew had become entangled in some barbed wire. He had, you know, wandered off to, like, after a deer or something and had gotten caught up in barbed wire. And the dog went and, you know, let everybody know and had them, you know, basically forced them to follow him over, and they found, you know, they found her nephew, and he's okay, thankfully. But, you know, it's sort of one of those things where it's like this dog, if he hadn't been there, what would have happened?
Yeah, yeah. Dogs can be great guardians for their kids. So let's talk about the news now. We're going to talk about that, our fundraiser on our Facebook page this week and so forth. I think the thing that got the most attention this week was the photograph, and this doesn't have to do with pit bulls, but it has to do with dogs in general, the photograph of the dog smiling, he wasn't really smiling, he was grimacing into the camera next to a kid, and everybody was saying, can't you see that dog is uncomfortable? You saw this?
I did. That photograph was terrifying.
Yeah, you could tell the dog was like, get away from me. Stop this ridiculousness.
There is a very sort of primal aspect when you see an animal that is displaying real aggression. You know, this sort of visceral gut reaction that you have to it. The person who had posted the picture, she had shared the picture with a news organization, and they posted the picture. She was saying that it was a smile, that the dog was smiling. And, you know, when a dog smiles, they have soft eyes. You know, they'll show their front teeth because they sort of pull their lips up. But, you know, there's a certain lack of tension in forehead.
There's a relaxation
ears are
there.
Usually,
yeah, I agree.
And this dog was, I mean, this dog looked like it was getting ready to kill somebody. It was just, you know, a really hard eye, very wide open, very stiff. You know, the whole face, the wrinkles, the ears, everything was just a very, you know, it was a very unfriendly posture. And this little, very young child is leaning in and kissing the side of his muzzle.
Mm-hmm. And of course, whoever's taking the picture is watching all this from a distance. It was very amazing. Yeah. Very amazing.
The mother. It was the mother who took the picture.
And
they actually subsequently published an article about this picture and the, you know, the sort of firestorm that happened about it on social media. I think it was like something like 80,000 shares before they ultimately removed the photograph. But, you know, in the article, the mother was trying to justify the interaction by saying that, well, he doesn't like his whiskers touched, and he was touching his whiskers, and he was probably just trying to move them so that, you know, he wouldn't touch them. And
well, that's just the same thing. The dog is still upset.
Yeah. And also went on to say that she had allowed her child to use the dog as a pillow, to use the dog as a stepping stool to get on the couch, like to do all these things, and then even admits that the dog isn't happy about it. And it, but like follows it up with the statement that he's a good dog.
Yeah.
Because, you know, apparently
he
a good
puts
dog
up with all this.
Can't. Yeah. Oh, obviously he is a good dog if he hasn't bitten thus far. I mean, considering the circumstances he's been put in, but you know, good, quote unquote, good dogs can and do bite because they are the ones that are pushed the hardest.
Yeah, that's right. So that got a lot of press, and I think rightfully so. I think there's, I think the good thing is there's more awareness in all these situations where people are taking pictures with dogs with little kids around that are close. And I think that's a good thing. I think that parents need to be educated about the folly of that, and particularly when you saw that dog's face, you could just tell the dog was very unhappy. And, you know, it's something that you got to pay attention to. So the other news that came out just before the show started today was that Steve Markwell was found guilty of 48 counts of violating state consumer protection laws. If you'll remember, Steve Markwell was the guy who ran the Olympic Animal Sanctuary, and Tamara Thane from Dogs Deserve Better went out there and protested, brought a lot of light to that situation, and Markwell subsequently packed up all the dogs into a 18-wheeler and drove them out to Arizona, where they were, where Mr. Pregelman from the Seattle Dog Spot, I think, has been covering the evolution of those dogs into as they integrate back into society. For those of you who I've been asked, you know, is this a criminal thing? Will he get jail time? I would say, and I can't say this for sure, but consumer protection laws are generally civil, and that means that he'll probably get fined, and he probably doesn't have any money. But it is a fact-finding, you know, thing that went forward, and I'll be looking to see, you know, what the exact what exactly comes, what there is more that comes out of that, because all we got was that blurb. There was a pit bull attack, a quote-unquote pit bull attack, in Florida this year in this week in Bradenton. And Chris and I have looked at the dog that was alleged to be a pit bull, and there's no way that the dog is predominantly of the three breeds commonly known as pit bull. The dog is, you know, he looks like my collie Barney. He's very long-legged. Doesn't have short fur. I don't know how anybody could identify this dog as a pit bull. Chris, your thoughts? What's happening on dogsbite.org about this?
Well, of course, I mean, you know, they don't care about facts or reporting or anything.
They don't?
Basically, yeah, they don't even care about headlines, because if the headline says dog, they have absolutely zero qualms about going in and changing the headline on Facebook.
What?
Exactly. So, you know, facts have never gotten in their way before, and it's not going to get in their way now.
I've actually seen them, just to say one thing, I've actually seen them identify a dog as a pit bull by looking at the friends of the owner on Facebook. And if all the friends have pit bull pictures, they'll say, well, obviously this dog's a pit bull because he hangs around with pit bull people.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, has to be, right?
Yep. So they're saying it's a pit bull. Your thoughts?
This dog, this is a head-scratcher when it comes to that great question of how on earth are people identifying these dogs?
Yeah.
You know, the dog does not have short hair. It's like a mid-length fur dog. He's very large from what I understand.
Yeah.
And so, you know, therefore is well out of the weight ranges of the typical breeds that you would see.
And the other thing is, I hate to interrupt you.
He's a big mixed breed.
Yeah, he does. But they also, of course, they showed blood all over him.
Yes.
The dog.
The photograph that they had of the dog was covered in blood. Our expert in the average Joe identification of a pit bull has determined that, you know, this dog does not fall in the definition of what the average person would consider a pit bull to be when viewing the picture. So,
yeah, well, it's not even close. I mean, the dog has simply got too long. The legs are too long. The dog is too rangy to be put in that class of dogs. So there was an attack in Bradenton, in Florida. It was not a pit bull. It was not a dog that has the predominant visual characteristics of a pit bull. And so I'm not going to talk about it. There was a pit bull that saved its owner from a fire in Indianapolis. Got people out of the house. The dog then went into the basement for some reason and had to be rescued, but it was okay. Another story that got a lot of traction this week was a dog that was a pit bull type dog that was in a shelter for 5 years, and he got some social media and he got adopted out. And even Glenn Greenwald, who is the guy who was involved with Snowden in the leaking case, tweeted a picture of the dog. So that article, all that stuff shows the power of social media in adopting out dogs. There was also an article in the South Carolina Times, which I thought was very interesting, which was entitled, "With People as with Pit Bulls, Let Facts Back Opinions." And basically, the author of this article said, you know, I was really hating pit bulls. I never met one. And then when I met one, I changed my mind. And this kind of reminds me of, you know, how you get over racial discrimination is by, you know, getting to know people that aren't the same as you and, you know, going to their houses and doing stuff with them. And then they're your friends. And then you go, well, they're normal. You know, they're just like me. They have the same desires and the same, you know, problems. Well, not the same problems, but I mean, they have the same basic needs that everybody has. And so, you know, I thought it was a nice article. Did you see it?
I did. It was a very good article. And it's actually particularly on point because I had a conversation with a committee member earlier in the week. And, you know, basically that's what it came down to. You know, I asked explicitly why he had the opinion of pit bulls that he did. And he was very honest with me, and I, you know, very much appreciated it, where he said that it's just what you hear. And, you know, he is a committee member in a town with a breed ban and has had it for quite some time. And, you know, has never met a pit bull and only knows what he's heard.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the problem. You've got people who don't know anything about them making decisions about them. About the law that relates to him. Dardanelle, Arkansas, sees two pit bulls. Apparently the vet who looked at them says they're less than 50%. Animal control, the police, and the mayor are all mum. They're going to have a meeting about it. In the meantime, the dogs are at the pound. Another example of, you know, poorly enforced bans separating dogs from their owners who have done nothing wrong. I saw an article in here that Adam Karp, who's a friend and a colleague of mine, a lawyer on the West Coast, has demanded repeal of the Fruitville and Payette, Idaho pit bull bans because of the definitions, which include purebreds. And then here's the tricky part. It also includes crossbreeds who, A, substantially conform, or B, are an element of breeding of pit bulls, or C, have characteristics partially of. Now, that definition in itself is so contradictory and vague that there's no way to enforce it. And it also, like the Salina, Kansas law, allows warrantless seizures of dogs by just having somebody think that it looks like a pit bull. So I don't think he's filed suit yet. I think he's sent a letter saying, please repeal, and if you're not, I'm going to file a suit. So we'll follow that along as that goes. And the last feel-good story of the week was the pit bull with the blind rat terrier, who was his buddy and you know, walked around with him to make sure he didn't bump into anything. They both got adopted together this week. Did you see that story?
I did. I'm glad they got adopted together. That's just such a sweet story, and you know, they deserve to remain together.
Yep. It kind of reminds me, there was a Great Dane who was a best friend of another Great Dane. Is that right? And one of them was blind.
Yes, and they would the one would lead the other one around.
Yes,
sort of
yeah, it was cool.
Through the world.
Yeah, it was really sweet. All right, let's take station identification and come back with what you've all been waiting for. What do we do when we go to the city commission meeting? We'll be right back after this word from our sponsor, us.
Pitt Bulletin Legal News Radio is brought to you by the Pitt Bulletin Legal News Network, the first and only network of pit bull-related information for owners, advocates, lawmakers, and the media. Visit our network of experts at www.pblnn.com for all things pit bull. Find news, upcoming and archived shows, statistics and studies, as well as ownership and advocacy information, all in one location. That's www.pblnn.com, the Pitt Bulletin Legal News Network. Pitt Bulletin Legal News Radio wants to hear from you. Email your news stories or tips to us at pittbulletinlegalnewsradio@gmail.com. Don't forget to tune in on Tuesdays at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time to catch the latest news about breed-specific legislation, dog bites, and litigation at www.blogtalkradio.com/pit-bulletin-legal-news. Join the discussion and chat or call us at 646-595-4137.
All right, we're back. You know, Chris, we've been on for 3 years now.
I know. It's been such a strange and long ride.
It has. It has been a strange and long ride. But I think, you know, I think we've covered a lot of areas out there, and I think we're the only radio show about pit bulls out there ever. So there you have it.
I mean, we definitely outlasted our good buddy Doug Wolf.
It's not saying much.
way back in the day when the show first started. And
yes, he would get on there and just talk by himself for however long. So, all right, so we're going to talk now about what to do when the city commission is getting ready to hear some public comment on pit bull laws, the laws that ban pit bulls. And I think, Chris, let's take turns. I'm going to start talking about, take the first thing, and let's take it in a linear order, talking about, I think the first question is, what do you wear? Do you wear your T-shirt? Do you wear your blame the breed, not the deed? Do you, you know, what do you do? And my answer to that is you dress as if you were going to court. If you have a jacket and tie, you know, you should wear that. If you don't have a jacket and tie, wear, you know, dress up. This is a situation where people are going to judge you on how you look, whether you like it or not. And if you want to be an advocate that makes a professional appearance, you know, that's important. I know it's not, a lot of people would say, well, that's not right, and, you know, you should be able to dress the way you want to. But the truth is, if you're going to go in front of the city commission and you're going to make a presentation, if you were, doing it for a zoning thing and you were a lawyer, you'd dress, you know, and your client, you'd have them dress up. It just shows professionalism, and you don't want to get into the situation where you all wear T-shirts to the place that are black that say, you know, ban the deed, not the breed. That's not helping. It's not helping to get in there in an emotional, personal way. What you want to do is you want to be seen as a person who has, you know, some kind of objectivity and some kind of a calm, rational argument to make. And part of that is how you're dressed. Your thoughts, Chris?
That was actually going to be the first thing that I was going to bring up, is how you present yourself. You know, especially in something like that, when you're dealing with city government, you want to be taken seriously. You want the people, the legislators, you know, either council or state legislators or what have you, you want them to look at you in a way that, you know, they're not going to be writing you off right away because, you know, you're wearing, like, dirty work clothes or, like you said, shirts, you know, the slogan shirts, stuff like that. When you present a professional appearance, they're more likely to listen to what you have to say. And it's unfortunate, you know, people like to say, oh, well, you know, we shouldn't be judged by what we wear and this and that. But it is a professional atmosphere. And, you know, you wouldn't go into an office building for work dressed like that. And it's sort of the same thing. This is these people's work. It's their job. You know, they are there doing their job. And, you know, it's sort of a sign of respect for the process and respect for the legislators when you present yourself in that nice professional attire.
All right. Your turn, Chris. You're number two.
Well, my number two is actually kind of goes in with the prep work. I suppose we could say picking an outfit is a bit of a prep work thing. When you're speaking in front of these people, there's always going to be a time limit. You're never going to be given an unlimited amount of time to say what you have to say. Now, what ends up happening in a lot of cases, particularly with this issue, is that a lot of people sign up to speak, and what they do is they cut people's time. So if you have, let's say, you know, they say on their website that public comments are 3 minutes apiece per person. Prepare your points and your speech or what have you for those 3 minutes, but also prepare a secondary one. Cut it down to 1 minute or, you know, a minute and a half or what have you. This way, I mean, you know, if you go in there with the 3 minute and the 1 minute thing and it turns out that they have to cut the time to be able to get everybody in to speak, you're not up there trying to rush. You have, you know, your main point that you want to make, you know, what you feel is the most salient point that you would like to make. They're ready to go and you're not caught off guard.
All right. My sub comment to that is, you really ought to write it out and time it. And when you watch guys who, at the highest level in Congress, when guys go to testify in Congress, they have a written speech that they read from. Now, I'm usually against reading a statement, because as a lawyer, when I'm in trial, you know, there is no script. You just do it. You ad lib it. But for this particular situation, I think you should write something down and read it. And you should time it so that it's 2 minutes or 3 minutes. And the reason is because you're going to be nervous. You're going to be it's not something that you can ad lib and keep your time to 3 minutes. If you start ad libbing, you're going to go off on a tangent and you're going to end up not making the points that if you had read it, you would have made. I know this because I've done it. I've gone in there and ad libbed and said, uh-oh, I've only got a minute left and I'm only halfway through. Because I thought I could ad-lib it. So when you look at the guys that go in Congress at the highest level of trying to persuade members of Congress, about they have written things that they read from, and I would suggest for the average person that it makes it the least stressful and the most efficient for you to make the points because you're reading them. Let me ask Laura what she thinks about that. Laura, what do you think about that?
Oh, along the lines of writing out your talk and timing it, you should also rehearse it.
Right, because that gives you more emotional.
Set a timer and have it buzz, have someone interrupt you, and see if you can do it without your papers in front of you.
Yeah.
Because I find that inevitably, if I have all my notes written, at some point I'm going to have like a little moment where I'm going to be like, where am I in my notes? And it will throw me off. So the more you can know it without having to look at something, the better.
I agree. And I think the writing thing for me would be the best. I mean, I would if I appear in front of somebody again to testify about that, I'm going to write it down because that's the only way you can time it correctly and make all the points in the order that you want to. In the most, I mean, that way it's all you're not leaving anything to chance. Okay, my next point, when you're preparing your talk and the points you want to make, stay away from "my dog is a great dog and therefore you shouldn't ban him." They're really not interested in, you're not making any valid point by talking about your own personal dog. you know, what the commissioners or whoever is sitting there will hear is nothing. They'll hear, okay, you love your dog. Thank you very much. That's all your, I don't care what you say, when you bring it back to, I have a dog and he's never bitten anybody and he gets along with kids and blah, that's not persuasive. Your thoughts, Chris?
I absolutely 100% agree. And in fact, I have been to meetings where somebody said something along those lines where they said, you know, this is my dog and he's a great dog and he loves, you know, XYZ and plays with kids and bunnies and, you know, poops rainbows and everything's perfect in our universe. The council member looked at the person and said, that's great that you love your dog. We all love our dogs. Your dog isn't the problem, but we feel like we have a problem.
Right.
So, you know, it is an emotional issue, and especially when, you know, it's a new law that's being considered and people get very upset at the prospect of, you know, potentially losing their dogs. You know, it's scary. But you have to stay away from those sort of emotional arguments because, you know, for every I love my dog story, somebody's going to be able to counter that with, look what this, you know, this pit bull attacked this child.
Right.
You know, we have to keep it in, on a factual basis. And leave, you know, personal experience, first-hand experience, you know, kind of out of it and stick to the facts and, you know, the
right.
verifiable things.
Yep. And it's kind of like Merritt Clifton with the anecdotal evidence. Anecdotal evidence doesn't help. It doesn't. There's no way to prove it. There's no way to disprove it. So you're sitting there with basically, you know, you're not doing anything. So, Laura, your thoughts on that?
It is really tiring to go in those meetings and just have people talk about how wonderful their dogs are. You can just see the council people's eyes glaze over.
Yep. Yep. So, all right, back to you, Chris. What next?
Well, I kind of want to go back just a tiny bit here when we were talking about having, you know, preparing your speech, timing it, rehearsing it, and stuff like that. And as far as when you're trying to decide what you want to include, keep it simple. You want to stick to two, maybe three points that you're going to address. If you start packing way too many different little bits of information in there, it starts to get a little overwhelming. And like Laura said, where they have sort of that, the eyes glaze over, you know, it's sort of the same thing where you're trying to get all this information in and trying to cram it in and cram it in. And there's nothing that can really be focused on. There's nothing that can really stand out when you're trying to put a bunch of things in there, especially considering that there are going to be a bunch of other speakers there. If you stick to, you know, one or two well-thought-out points and potentially, hopefully, and I would suggest, highly suggest this, have printed material there that you can distribute to go into those points a little more in-depth. This way, you know, they can look at it. You could sort of make these points as a CliffsNotes version of them, and then have the material to give to them, you know, kind of take some of the work out of it for them. This way, you know, they're not getting overwhelmed with just your one speech.
Right. And I would say, as a subpart to this about the preparing, if you could get your people together before the meeting, and Josh Liddy did this when he was doing it, and it was a very great technique to use. You're not going to get everybody who's going to present to come together in one place, but if you can, then you guys can start splitting up who's going to talk about what, because there's an incredible amount of repetition in this stuff. You know, you get in there and somebody brings up topic X, and you're going to talk about topic X. Now, immediately, you know, if you're going to go third, what you were going to say has already been covered. Would it not be better if you knew what the number one speaker through five was going to talk about, so you could talk as number six about something new? Even if it wasn't something that you really cared about, it would be, as a whole, the presentation would be better because there wouldn't be so much repetition. So what Josh did was he got on Facebook and said, look, anybody who's going to this meeting tomorrow, let's have a meeting at my house, you know, tonight at 9 o'clock or tomorrow at 9 o'clock before the thing. And he got a fair amount of people there who were able to coordinate all this stuff and give a much better presentation.
And if you can't do that, it kind of goes back to, you know, what I was saying, we're having your longer version and your shorter version. You know, if they're going to end up cutting your time and somebody ahead of you makes one of the points that you had sort of plotted out in your longer version, you have a couple of others to pick from. So, you know, it might be a good idea to have maybe a couple of backups. This way you're not, you know, necessarily repeating information. Or if you have something that you can expand on a point without repeating it,
right.
You know, just being well-researched in the points that you want to make.
And if you're really suave and really on it, what you could do is make a list of all the points that should be made. And when you get up, only cover those ones that haven't been covered. That would be the way to do it. But I do believe that providing the council with documents is important. So if you intend to talk about a study, if you can give that study to each one of the councilmen at the beginning of your thing so that they have it. And if you, for example, were a person who got to have a 15-minute talk like we did when we were in Boston, I mean, we put together a notebook that was great, and they started referring to it because it was the only one they got that really was – it was indexed, it was in a notebook, it had all the studies, it had all the stuff we wanted to have in it. It even had the bite statistics from Boston, which their own animal control people didn't supply. So, Laura, your thoughts on that process?
I thought that was really important. And we had like three speakers from Pit Bulls and Legal News, and we all covered different territory. And I think having the binder was really valuable.
Yeah,
council people really, and the committee members seem really interested in that, and
they actually read it. I mean, I remember one guy was up there, and he said, "Well, what about these bite statistics too?" I remember he asked us or he asked another witness, but he had them there, and he was interested in reading them, and nobody had provided them, which to me was showed the weakness of Boston Animal Control because they didn't provide their own bite statistics.
And what was fantastic is that the one person testifying in favor of reallowing BDL, you know, the Boston Animal Control officer, he went after we did, so they had the binder when he spoke.
Yeah.
And they questioned him on some of the information that we had, and he could not come up with an answer.
Right. That's the sweetest of all, if you can get away, if you can do that. There's no way you can get any better than that. All right, Chris, next advice.
Well, excuse me. Sorry about that. When you're addressing the council, it can be difficult to avoid inflammatory language, but I have to really stress, even if it's low-grade inflammatory language, referring to the idea of a breed discriminatory law is stupid. Or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah.
You want to avoid any kind of assaultive language, anything that could be perceived as an attack. You know, even if it's really, like, even if it's very moderate, what ends up happening is the person that you're speaking to is going to shut down. You know, like I said, even if it's not, you know, you're not insulting the person, even if you're just insulting the proposal, or the law, you know, depending on the situation, that still causes them to shut down because they just, you know, nobody wants
well,
to
Well, you don't know what their position is. You don't know what their position is. If you don't know what their position is and they're for it and you say it's stupid, guess what?
Mm-hmm.
It's not good.
Yeah,
now, here's how I would
– here. Them.
This is how I think you can make the most persuasive argument to a city council about – and it's when I used to do voir dire as a lawyer, I used to say I'd have a case where there was a problem. And what I would say to the jury was, you know, I'm worried that you're – let's say I represent a guy who drives a motorcycle. And I say, you know, I'm really worried that because some of you may have had some bad experiences with motorcycle drivers, that you're going to make it – you're going to let that prejudice affect – how you view my client, who's a motorcycle driver, even though he isn't the one who did all that. And my thought is that if you're going to talk to the council, I think one of the best and most open-ended way to talk to them is to say, you know, I see that we're trying to pass breed discriminatory laws, but my worry is that if we do this, we're not going to be able to properly identify pit bulls. And so now what you're doing is you're taking what is a valid, you know, scientific argument, and you're sort of putting it to them in a way that says, aren't you worried about this too, and making it much less combative. Your thoughts, Chris?
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. You want to sort of present things in a way, I mean, I guess the best way I could say it is you're almost kind of trying to lead them into these thoughts.
Right.
You know, where you're not making, you know, you're not making hard, like, accusatory statements. You're raising points in a way that gets the person thinking about things that they may not have considered, and sort of trying to take their hand and walk them down the path of, you know, where your thought is going to go. And you want to try to do that in as, you know, diplomatic and gentle a way possible. We know that the more you kind of try to push somebody into changing their point of view, the more embedded in that point of view they become.
Yep.
But if you can get it to word it into a way where, you know, they sort of feel like they're thinking of it themselves, they are much more likely to change their mind. They're much more likely to be open to, you know, the points that you're making, because it's, you know, kind of, I guess maybe they feel like it's, you know, partially their idea in a way, but it, you know, it's a little tricky and a little political, but I think it's a much more effective route than trying to sort of manhandle somebody into changing their mind.
Well, whenever you say you're worried about something, it's sort of like you're in it with them, you know, and they're saying, okay, you're worried about it. You're not saying it's stupid. You're not saying, boy, this is a crappy idea. You're not saying this proposal's, you know, any of that. You're just saying, I'm worried about this part of it. Because we have studies that show blah, blah, blah. And to me, that's just that kind of argument is a lot more successful. For example, when they teach you as a lawyer, when you're making a closing argument, don't tell the jury what to do. Don't say, you got to find this guy guilty. You got to say things like, okay, the guy, after he was arrested, he fled the jurisdiction. What does that make you think? And then you let them say, it makes me think that he fled because he was guilty. But you're not telling them what to think, is the point. Laura, your thoughts?
I think that's a really excellent point about not beating people over the head with your ultimate position and trying to guide them towards a common goal. Especially another thing to emphasize is public safety.
Right.
You really emphasize that you want public safety too. You just want to go about it in the most efficient way possible.
Right. Absolutely. If you share, if you can point out that you're sharing, what you're doing is sharing a common goal, and that the only thing that you're really discussing here is the manner in which it's going to be done, and that let's think about this and use science and objectivity about it, there's really no way that somebody can criticize that. So, you know, I think that it's very important not to be confrontational. I think the minute you're confrontational, they tune you out and they say you're another pit bull nut who, if your dog attacked somebody, you'd say it was the victim's fault. You know, I think that that is a very counterproductive strategy. All right, Chris, next point. What do you think?
When you're presenting information to the council, generally the reason you're there is because somebody is taking a blanket position on a, you know, pit bulls or, you know, Rottweilers, what have you, whatever dog is being considered targeted or is being targeted. When you're making points against these sorts of laws, it is incredibly important for you to not throw other dogs under the bus. When you go up and you're speaking to a council, if you make statements like, you know, oh, well, you know, XYZ breed bites more.
Right.
what you're effectively doing is you're saying that aggression is a breed-specific trait.
Yep.
It just doesn't apply to whatever breed they're considering at the moment.
Yeah, you're just arguing about which breed is the worst.
Yes, exactly. You get into a position where you're arguing about, you know, this breed is worse than this one, so, you know, you shouldn't legislate this one. And it lends credence to the idea that there is, in fact, a breed-specific issue with aggression and with dog bites specifically, and that it is just breed that's the issue, and that it's not, you know, handling, it's not management and all that stuff. So as tempting as it might be to go up and say, well, I have, you know, there's a study that says that dachshunds are more aggressive than pit bulls. Don't do it. Please, just stay away from that sort of information.
Yeah, I think that's a wise course. I think that any kind of argument that makes the case that any dog is, I mean, how can you make an argument that there's no evidence that pit bulls are more dangerous than other dogs, but there are, if you say Dobermans are more, you know, of a problem. I think you have to go back to the, you know, we're all for public safety, and, you know, we're just as you know, in favor of public safety as everyone else is here. The only difference is that we want to do it for all dogs, which is truly the way to do it. The last point, I guess, we'll cover. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to really quickly expand on that. In addition to, you know, not throwing other breeds under the bus, on the flip side of that, you want to avoid this line of rhetoric that says, basically goes along with, like, every single pit bull wears a halo.
Right.
Because the fact of the matter is that pit bulls have bitten. You know, there are aggressive dogs that can be identified as pit bulls. You know, it's that these are facts. And sitting up there and telling the council, you know, how great every single member of a breed is just as bad as saying how every single member of the breed is bad.
Right.
You know, you have to present a very realistic and balanced approach to them. And the minute you start making the blanket statement as all of them are good, I think you lose credibility. And again, you sort of go back to this idea that you can just make blanket statements about breeds.
I think the best way to handle that is to say, and it also covers the argument that pit bulls do more damage than other dogs, is I would simply say, look, we're here for public safety against all dogs, and all big dogs do more damage than little dogs. But we want to include all dogs in this law, not just a specific breed. The last thing I'll talk about is this a real problem that I've seen and I've had to deal with, and it's really hard, is when you're doing public comment and the person gets up whose son has been mauled by a pit bull fatally, and they're crying and they're, you know, they're really emotional, and now you're next. You have to handle this. And it has to be done. It really is a very sensitive time in the presentation, because you don't want to, you need to be sympathetic to that person. And you need to spend most of your time saying that's terrible, you know. And then you have to turn the argument to say, but we can't make, you know, our laws based on what happened to one person. You know, I mean, that's just how democracy works. You know, you can't make the government can't ban something based on what happened to one person. And while it's terrible what happened, and I agree that, you know, that owner was irresponsible and it's terrible, that's not the basis to make public policy. What is your thought on that, Chris?
I would agree with that, and I would also say, excuse me, sorry about that. I'm going to be coughing everybody's ears.
Just don't really spark,
you know,
give
I
me
would,
the clue.
I would also say that, you know, when you're sort of dealing with following that sort of situation, you know, you do want to stress that. Like, for example, sometimes in these situations, and this may or may not be the case if this happens to you when you're trying to, you know, speaking, But if this is a situation where the person has not been held accountable for, you know, an attack on the person that's speaking, or for the relative or what have you, I think it's really important to stress that, you know, we need to find ways to hold people accountable, all of them, so that happened to somebody else where that person just sort of gets away with letting their dog attack.
Well, in my case, the dog was euthanized, but the problem was, and what this woman was trying to say, her son was seriously mauled by a dog, and what she was saying was that there should be insurance requirements because the person in this case, she had $10,000 worth of medical bills that weren't paid, and the person who owned the dog had no insurance and no assets, and she's sitting there, you know, in that situation. And there ought to be something done about that. And, you know, my answer to that is, well, if you're going to have to require insurance, you're going to have to require insurance on all dogs because all dogs bite. And, there's no – and I don't – my thought, my recollection is that it was brutal. I mean, I got up and I was like, wow, how would I follow that? And I actually said, wow, it's really difficult to present following that, you know, that emotional appeal, and I feel I just want this, you know, the presenter to understand that everybody, I'm sure everybody here feels sympathetic and sorry that it happened and wish they could go back in time and stop it from happening, but, you know, that can't be done. And in terms of what do we learn from that, the answer is that we need to have, you know, there's no way to make every person who owns a dog have insurance. It's just not going to happen. But it's a tough one.
It is. I think that's probably one of the more difficult parts of speaking in these sorts of situations.
It is. They're passed. It's why Miami got passed. Was the lady whose son was, you know, was in the hospital, came and testified in front of the commission, and within 6 months they passed it. This is what. That emotional appeal, there's almost no way to get the same emotion on our side. You can't. All you can do is try to tease out the difference between what happened in that case and public policy.
Yes, and I think a strength in that is definitely, you know, stressing that by having a really good, strong, neutral, dangerous dog law, you know, you're covering all the other dogs that attack, but pit bulls aren't getting a pass. And I think that's actually a point that sometimes needs to verbally be made to certain legislators, particularly in cases of a repeal, because they sort of have this feeling like if they repeal a breed discriminatory law, they're going to end up with, you know, pit bulls running loose and all hell is going to break loose and this and that. And it's like, no, these things are still covered. These people are still going to be held accountable, you know, because they, you know, get a really good, solid, breed-neutral, dangerous dog law in. And then dogs that are, you know, any dog, pit bull or not, that is not being managed properly in the community, that is a danger to the community, will be covered. And then,
well,
you know, the other, because there's always that, you know, like, they always say, oh, well, 15% of attacks are by dogs identified as pit bulls. And then, you know, we can say 100% of attacks are now going to be covered versus targeting out these 15%.
Well, I think if you're going to argue that, you have to know what the dangerous dog covers and doesn't cover. And you need to be able to say,
yes,
well, you can do this by expanding the definition of what actions a dog has to take to be declared dangerous. So, and I think that's a very effective way. But you'd have to have done your homework. It's not, you know, you'd have to have looked at the dangerous dog law and say, okay, where does this fall short in terms? Because there are some places that don't even have a dangerous dog. I mean, I didn't know this until I wrote this article that I did. But some places don't have any dangerous dog law. So if a dog bites somebody, there's nothing that can be done. So, you know, I think that that it's important for communities to have dangerous dog laws and to have ones that are fair. And where a person gets, you know, due process and has the right to go and contest it and get the facts out so you don't end up with animal control running amok But I think that's a great point. I think that you do need to know the dangerous dog law and say, so that if somebody says, well, you know, if this happens, you can say, well, if that happened, it would be covered under the dangerous dog law under this section. And if it wasn't covered, what you would say is, well, that's not covered under the dangerous dog law, and you guys need to fix that so that if it does happen, everybody's has, you know, that's a part of the sanctions against someone who's an irresponsible owner. So, Laura, your thoughts on this? You're going to get the final say here.
Well, I would just like to direct our listeners to a couple of the presentations we have on pitbulletinlegalnews.com or pbln.com. I'll put the links on Facebook. But both Letty Van Cabbage and Cabbage, I think I said Cabbage by accident, and Kim Wolf gave excellent presentations on our radio show last maybe a year and a half ago and have some really informative presentations that we put online talking about which messages are most effective
yes,
and how to
that's true.
Those messages.
That's
and
true.
They're definitely worth taking a look at.
I totally agree with you. Letty had best friends had paid a focus group to, and this is the most sophisticated thing I've ever seen done, was basically Letty and some of her colleagues would make arguments to people who were in a room with a dial, and as they listened, they would turn the dial to see, you know, what was persuasive to them. And many of the arguments that we commonly make are not persuasive. So, for example, the argument...
Huh? Property rights turned out to be one of the most persuasive arguments.
Yeah, the most persuasive argument was the NRA argument, which is we live in America. If we're responsible owners, we should be able to have any dog we want. That argument resonates with Americans because we're very individualistic, and that's part of the American culture. And that's what the NRA uses. If I'm a responsible owner of a gun, I should be able to have any gun I want. So, Kim Wolf had some great things about how some of the, blame the deed, not the breed, all these kind of, how they misfire when you're in there. And I think both of those presentations are a lot more sophisticated than ours was tonight. So I would recommend you listen to them. And that's a good point, Laura, as always. All right, we're going to take a little station identification and be back with the sultry, hot, glacier-melting Yvette Van Veen.
You're listening to Pit Bulletin Legal News Radio. Follow us by clicking the follow link in the upper left-hand corner at www.blogtalkradio.com/pit-bulletin-legal-news. Or better yet, join our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/pitbulletinlegalnews to hear the latest news and updates during the week. Join the discussion during the show by logging into chat as a guest through Facebook or call us at 646-595-4137.
All right, we're back. We have on our show the person responsible for global warming. She is so hot in Canada that the polar ice caps are melting. Let's welcome to the show Yvette Van Veen.
And it goes on. And it goes on.
Welcome to the show, Yvette.
Hello, Fred. How are you?
Well, I was just mentioning to our listeners that you're responsible for global warming because you have all that heat up there and you're melting all the Canadian ice.
I wish. I still have ice in the backyard. I don't think so. It can't be me. It's not possible.
No, that's what Chris told me. She said that that when you go outside in the backyard, the snow retreats at least a foot from where you are.
Oh, is that what it is?
That you don't even have to. She told me that you don't even have to shovel. You just walk out into your sidewalk, and as you walk out, the snow recedes.
I was going to say, my phone is beeping on me tonight. I just messaged Chris, and I was like, just in case it cuts me out. Oh, my God, I don't know what's going on with the phone. It just keeps cussing me out tonight. I would say it needs charging, except I took it off the charger. So
I think you should hold it with tongs. I think your heat is getting to the innards of that phone and causing it to malfunction.
Yeah, smoking hot. Yeah, funny.
So let's ask Chris the topic for tonight because she's always the topic holder for our show.
Okay.
Were we going to talk about global warming and Yvette or something else?
No, we're going to talk about something else.
Oh, dang.
Sorry, Yvette. I don't mean to, you know, gloss over the whole, like, connection between you and global warming.
Okay, yeah, because when you hey, it's observable, and observation is scientific research, right? No, wait, did I get that wrong?
Nice.
Anecdote is, evidence? I don't know. Yeah, so what's the topic?
Anecdote is not data.
Yes, like, that's the one.
So I wanted to talk about something that I've been extremely excited about lately.
This I've got to hear.
People probably are going to make a funny face when I say what it is I'm excited about lately.
I'm dying.
I have been excited about mechanics.
Ah. Oh, Brad's going to go there. You keep going there.
The mechanics of what? That's the question.
Oh, I thought he was going to say that she must be, like, really into, like, going to the mechanic, and, you know, there's some really nice-looking dude there.
He does mechanic work topless, is what I heard.
It's a Playgirl catalog.
And he's all greasy and everything, you know, and he has, like, a paddle in the back of his seat for 50
Shades
of gray.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way with the mechanics anymore. It's all electronics and cold and clinical. They got to change that reputation. Yeah.
Wow, you gals really are on it. Go ahead.
The mechanics of dog training, of course.
Yep.
Not mechanics, and why these things are so important.
Yes. Okay.
I saw, you know, there was a comment that I had seen on a group regarding somebody who had they were having difficulty with loose leash walking. And a dog that was apparently a very, very hard puller. And there was somebody who had sort of been venting about this post, I guess, and the fact that people were making suggestions about that the person, the dog owner, was potentially not doing things correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And this person seemed to take it really, really personally that somebody had dared suggest that the person was not, was not doing the methods that she had tried the right way.
Yep.
So, you know, that sort of got me thinking about, like, okay, well, you know, I've been seeing a lot, thanks to a training challenge that we've been doing with Yvette, how important mechanics are. So, you know, I wanted you to talk a little bit about, like, watching these things, why they are so important, and you know, the difference that they make in...
And we also want you to comment on whether they have any relationship to human interaction.
To human interaction?
Yes. Mechanics.
Well, I mean, just to kind of, I guess, give a little backstory, basically what happened was, it sort of stemmed, I think, from the defensiveness that comes out of the suggestion of, somebody's using positive reinforcement, they're saying it's not working, and then somebody comes out and says, well, have you worked on your, you know, rate of reinforcement or your timing or those types of suggestions, those mechanical fixes that says, which basically say, did you really do it right? That's the underlying question. And what ends up happening is that, of course, tends to trigger a real defensive response, especially if you're on training lists where there's trainers or people who are in dog sports. Of course I did it right. This isn't my first rodeo. I've been doing this for 10 years, and I've worked with 10,000 dogs. It really creates 10,000 dogs.
You always say 10,000.
Yeah, but it creates that real... that real knee-jerk reaction of how, I don't want to use the word ego, but maybe I guess sometimes our ego is tied into our skills to a certain degree. And of course, as soon as you say that, then of course the insults start flying the other way, which is that if you even dare suggest that somebody might look at their mechanics, that it's that you're trying to one-up people or show off, and, you know, it just gets into this whole horrific Facebook thing.
This sounds awesome. Can I join?
Can you join the fight? Yeah,
yes.
You just instigate.
If you want.
You? Yeah, you'd be instigating it. But it starts to turn into this tit-for-tat, and then, of course, it leads to blog posts where people are stuff that really seriously takes away from dog training and helping dogs. So this whole thing led to this sort of little training challenge that just kind of started on the fly, where it was like, hey, anybody interested, let's work on teaching this skill together. And if you want to learn how to clicker train and maybe learn to do it a bit better, come join us. And I'm sort of moderating it and, you know, offering suggestions. So we're having a blast with it. It's really, it's got a real positive vibe to it. And the skill that we're doing is the dog has to touch with their nose a target, but then they have to learn to hold it for 10 seconds so their nose stays on the target. And most people get the first bit, the touch part, really easily, and then they just crash and burn as soon as you want them to stay on the target. And that's because of mechanics. And
I thought it was because of the Internet and we had a short attention span.
It could be because nobody ever goes there in terms of teaching the next step. And it's interesting watching people's process as they're kind of working through those little details where if I'm working with my dogs and I'm doing it, you know, I do sort of one session, two sessions, three sessions. Yeah, the dogs have the hold. And it starts, you know, people start using words like, oh, my God, it's like magic. And it's like, no, it's mechanics. That's all it is. It's not ego. It's not anything. It's just you have to know these little details that can either shoot you in the foot and you will crash and burn. And a lot of people are crashing and burning on that one skill. Versus if you know what you're doing, everything just comes together and the results are screaming fast. So it's been kind of interesting. I think sometimes it's a topic that gets maybe because of that knee-jerk reaction, the defensive reaction and that. And what's neat with Chris is watching her when she had her epiphany. She went from having like these struggles to the next day going, we've got 6 second duration. It was just this night and day difference. And just by making some tiny little changes, and it's really, you know, and other people are kind of having their little breakthrough moments right now as well. And it's really a topic that I think needs more attention and that people would get faster, better, more effective results if they just had access to a tiny bit more information. So, I mean, I don't know if there's so you want to sort of add your perspective from the training challenge, Chris, in terms of...
I think she should.
Yeah, in terms of what she's learned from it, because otherwise I'm just kind of saying, I'm awesome, I ran this thing. But I'd rather I'd love to hear her side of it and say sort of what's important as a takeaway.
Yeah, you know, I think there's sort of this idea about, like a marker training or a clicker training is, you know, I guess more of what people think of that, you know, you just sort of do it. And, you know, it's just something that you could pick up like in a book or whatever and just kind of pick up the clicker and go for it and be able to get these sort of results that you see in a lot of videos, like on YouTube, where, you know, the dogs are doing a lot of very impressive tricks and they're doing, you know, competitive obedience and stuff like that. And, you know, I will be the first to say that I kind of had that original idea, you know, when I had started kind of working with the, you know, my dogs in my life and doing this stuff. But then when you really sort of sit down and you have something like this where, you know, it's a specific thing that a bunch of people are working on together and sort of looking at each other's videos and talking about why things are working and why they're not working, you kind of realize that, yeah, the basic idea is there that you have, you know, the clicker and it marks the behavior and you reward the dog and everything. But all of those other things that happen around the behavior have to happen in the right way.
Yep.
And the smallest little thing changes what you're doing and, like Yvette said, how fast it ends up happening for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, just, like for me, it was where you're feeding was,
yeah,
like the big thing.
Yeah, I think for you, all you really changed was what? It was maybe about 5 centimeters difference. You moved your hand, and you went from can't to, oh, my God, we have it. It was 5 centimeters difference from success and frustration. It's that.
5 centimeters is how much in inches?
It is 2 inches.
All right.
I can convert our systems. Don't you worry.
Right. I couldn't answer that one, but, and you know, it's that idea that, you know, you have to think about where you're feeding and what is happening as a result of it.
Yep.
And all those sorts of little things that are happening around the behavior that you're teaching, if you're not getting them right, then, you know, it's going to be something that you just sort of tread water on.
Well,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. You finish.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and I think that translates then into, you know, this is just a sustained nose touch, but that translates into, you know, larger behaviors that have a larger impact on the dog's day-to-day life that are, you know, they're difficult for a lot of people to achieve, and they're difficult for people to address. And, you know, I think it comes down to, because nobody has really sort of, nobody's either shown or told the person how these other things that are happening while you're trying to teach the behavior are sort of sabotaging you.
Yeah, self-sabotaging is a great word. And I think the knee-jerk reaction that even I think seasoned professionals would probably say if people are struggling is they'd say, drop your criteria, drop your expectations on the dog, make it easier, right? And you hear that over and over and over again. But with this exercise, what I love about it is even if you do that and then gradually come back up again, if your position of feeding is out, you hit the same brick wall every single time if your feeding is in the wrong location. And you can, and that's, I think, when people start saying, I did it right, I dropped the criteria, I rebuilt it. It's not working. And it's like, well, you can keep doing that till the cows come home. It's not going to work. Good one. And I think that's where people start saying the different dogs need different strategies. It doesn't work for all dogs. And what I had done is with Kip and Karma, I did Karma correctly. And with Kip, I made that mistake to show how quickly it would fall apart for him. And it was astounding to me. Like, I knew it would happen, even the speed at which his behavior fell apart, by feeding in the wrong position. And you can see him shut down and fuss. And I think that's also what gives the impression of neurotic clicker trained dogs, where they're, you know, they're flopping about, they're like flapping their paws, grabbing at things, frustrated, you know, and there's some people who I think legitimately might even say, these dogs look stressed. It's like, well, yeah, that's because whoever is teaching you to do it this way, they're not aware of the mechanics well enough, and the dog is stressed because it's wrong. And if you do it correctly, you see the dogs calm down and focus. And I just did the one where I said, okay, Kip's done enough of the wrong stuff. Let's start him over and do it right. And within two sessions, you can see his duration kick in, and you can see him calm right down. It's like completely different dog within 24 hours. And it is kind of, it's when you kind of see it progressing and you talk about it. I think it's been a great week in terms of that training challenge and everybody working and discussing. And, you know, who doesn't want to train their dogs better, faster, more effectively? And it's all it is 5 centimeters.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
And, I mean, and, you know, I think you're dead on about that, you know, idea of, like, well, different dogs need different, you know, different methods in order to teach them whatever, you know, it doesn't really matter what behavior it is. It's a general statement you hear all the time.
Yep.
And, you know, I will say that having the two dogs and, you know, two different personalities and teaching the same thing to them at the same time, there are slight adjustments that I have to make in what I do with them. But at the same time, all those, like, basic theories of where I'm feeding, where's the target, you know, all that stuff, all of that is absolutely the same.
Yep, and they get
it's
it.
Just,
it's not,
know,
that one dog doesn't understand. It's, sure, they're different. Kip is very different from Karma. And I'm the first person that hears, well, you know, you have a border collie. They're Jedi mind readers. Of course it works for her. And so I'm probably saying, yeah, let me get my other dog for you. Works on him too. Actually, I have to just be a little tighter on my mechanics with them. The thing with some dogs is you can be sloppy and they're forgiving and they do it despite our mistakes. And I think that's where you get the sort of one-hit wonder trainers that have one dog that makes them look awesome, is they got lucky. The real sort of test is, can a can somebody replicate that with any dog? And that's skill, that's versus luck. And yeah, karma's more of a Jedi mind reader, but I know it'll work for Kip too.
Well, let me ask you this, Yvette. What did you think of the picture of the kid with the dog grimacing?
Cringe. You know what?
I want to get a professional.
I was having so much fun on training challenge stuff. I was the kid that was, yeah, the dog that's, and everybody's kind of going, oh, he's fine. You know what? But I think it's, regardless of what the, I mean, first of all, I think it's ridiculous to even somehow try to justify that the dog's fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sort of, and I think it was printed in a newspaper too, and it's like, then you have the whole editorial staff somehow thinking this is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're changing their tune on that. But even the life lesson to kids growing up to say, yeah, somebody's showing discomfort, so keep doing what you're doing. To
yeah.
me, it's just even in terms of a life lesson, because those lessons, they carry forward even to your interactions with people. That if someone says, hey, I'm really not comfortable, what you're doing is not making me feel too good, we need to have those skills to say, I'm sorry, I'll stop that because I know it bothers you. That we have these communicative skills and respect for one another. So, I mean, all across the board, that entire thing, it just makes me cringe on so many levels that I don't understand why we'd even be having this discussion at this point in time, you know, and why anybody would think it's okay. And I think we have to kind of go back to the idea of, you know, it's okay to respect somebody else's space, including dogs.
And Chris says that apparently the person who owned the dog was saying that the kid used the dog as a stool.
Yep.
You know, all that kind of thing.
Or a pillow or something, I thought I read. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
Which, you know, it's that's not giving a good sort of lesson for the kid either, I don't think.
No, I agree. I can't see anything good about it at all. Like, there's nothing that I can see in it where it makes me say, you know, like there's anything there to be copied or desired. And it astounds me that here we are trying to deal with ridiculous dog laws aimed at breeds, and that this is still okay.
No,
I mean, it seems the common sense, logical thing is to start saying we need to start addressing human behavior and our expectations of what dogs should be capable of handling is really unrealistic. And I'm not saying, my dog's like, Karma goes into schools. She's the first one to be handled by kids. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that we live a life where we don't touch our dogs.
Well, there's a difference between touching and using your dog as a stool.
Exactly. Huge difference.
Yeah.
So it's that respect.
And what happens when that kid gets bigger?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
it happened without reason, without warning. He used to be so good. We used to use
yeah.
him as a stool.
Yeah.
That might actually be why he has a problem now.
That's
exactly.
Right.
That over time, that started getting on his nerves. And it wouldn't surprise me one bit. So.
Now, Chris, do you have any last parting words here, since we're winding down here with a minute left?
No. I think we sort of hashed out about this thing, this story earlier, and I think I set my piece on it.
Okay. All right. Well, Yvette, I hope that you don't melt the global ice cap any more than you already have today.
Okay.
If you stay inside, you'll be fine, and we'll be fine. We won't have the seas rise and all that.
Okay.
And I hope that our listeners had an educational session listening to us discuss our experiences with presenting the case against breed discriminatory laws. And I hope that you check out the other two things, the Letty Van Cabbage and Kim Wolf presentations in our prior shows. And we hope you'll tune in next week for another exciting and unbelievable edition of Pit Bulletin Legal News Radio. Have a great week. Be safe. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.